The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have lots to get to on today's program. Coming up in the next segment, the second segment, we'll talk some about just all of the sexual scandals that we see all over the news. It's making quite a lot of headlines here in the UK, not just with the Harvey Weinstein mess, but also other accusations that are just seem to be springing up all over the place. And we'll look in the next segment about, well, we'll take you back to some of the things that Herbert Armstrong had to say about this this wild pendulum swing from the old morality to the new. It just seems like man is always he's always moving from one extreme to the other, and we're seeing some of that same tendency today. And there's a pretty good piece too in I believe it's The Spectator, which we'll be going through in just a little bit as well. But first, I wanted to start with Lebanon and Saudi Arabia too. You see quite a few headlines now about Saudi Arabia in crisis. In just really the last few days, we've seen the government in Lebanon fall into disorder, starting with Prime Minister Hariri's resignation, I believe, on Saturday. He made this announcement from Saudi Arabia, and Hariri said that he feared for his life. He left little doubt about where he believes the threat on his life is coming from, blaming it on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, the reason I think we want to keep our eyes on this is because of that Psalm 83 alliance, and the Trumpet has been saying for many years, for decades, in fact, that Iran would eventually lose control of Lebanon, and that it would somehow or another enter into an alliance with Saudi Arabia. And we don't know exactly if this is what's playing out with Hariri's resignation, but the fact that Saudi Arabia is clearly involved in this, the fact that he made the announcement from Saudi Arabia suggests again that Saudi Arabia is on to Iran and what Iran's getting away with in Lebanon. And so here is an ally. Hariri's an ally of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia evidently just said, all right, that's enough. It's time for you to resign. Lebanon, in the lead up to Hariri's election in 2016, by the way, it was in a state of political turmoil. They had a president there that was very, very much pro-Hezbollah. And then you had Hariri, who was more of an ally of Saudi Arabia, in the office of prime minister. And since that time, I mean, since he was elected in 2016, he really has found it very difficult to govern because Hezbollah had quite a few gains in that 2016 election, if you remember. If you read thetrumpet.com at the time, I mean, they've gained credibility politically, and it's undermined Hariri's ability to govern. So he finally steps down. Just as a matter of a few days ago. And it's probably a case where Saudi Arabia just didn't want him to stay on and to give Iran more legitimacy in government there in Lebanon. And since he's stepped down, I mean, the government in Lebanon has just descended into further turmoil. And then you have the spat now between Saudi Arabia and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And so this is something that I don't think will escalate into full-scale war. But as far as watching for things to be reshuffled, according to that Psalm 83 alliance, this is something that we definitely definitely want to keep our eyes on. My father had an article back in 2014, Why You Need to Watch Lebanon. That was the title of the piece. You can look at it at thetrumpet.com. But in that article, he goes through the Psalm 83 alliance. He quotes from Lang's commentary how that this is an alliance that has never formed in history. So it's clearly for the end time. And then he says here, if we believe what our Bible states, then we must believe this alliance against Israel. That's what it's ultimately for, or in opposition to Israel. It's still to come. It's for the future. It says, and we can know even more. We can know who will be in the alliance. So there's going to be two camps. There's going to be two camps in the Middle East. You're going to have the pro-Iranian camp, and you're going to have the pro-Saudi Arabian camp, and Lebanon eventually, somehow, some way or another, will swing into the Saudi Arabian camp. So definitely fascinating to watch what's been happening with Saudi Arabia, with Lebanon, just in the last few days. Shifting gears now over to Germany. On Friday's program, we played this short clip from my father's Key of David program, and this is a comment that he made about the Daniel 8 man. You're familiar with this prophecy, of course. It's from a program my father gave in 2010 titled The End Time Antiochus. Here's clip 5.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process. It says here something like that. And perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition, but he's going to come in by flatteries.
He's going to come in by flatteries. We know that from Daniel 11. This Daniel 8 strongman, a king of fierce countenance, the Bible says. But if you notice in that statement, it says that he's probably going to take advantage of a weak coalition. And just about every article coming out now about Germany's government is talking about a weak coalition. It's talking about a coalition that may well not even come together. There's a Politico piece here. I didn't get a chance to get to this yesterday, but it says here, refugee question threatens German coalition talks. I mean, it's threatening to undermine the formation of this coalition, the migrant question. It says the migration question, which loomed large in Germany's fall election, now threatens to dash her efforts to form a new government. It says further, Germany's future course on refugees quickly emerged as one of the most contentious in ongoing exploratory coalition talks between Merkel's conservatives, the liberal Free Democrats, and the Greens. So you've got the Conservative Party, then you've got the sister party in Bavaria. Those two are in, well, they're close. The ties there are strong. But they need the liberal Free Democrats and they need the Greens to form this coalition, these smaller groups. They need them in order to form a government. It says last week, a top conservative negotiator even accused the Greens, who advocate less stringent asylum and refugee policies, of trying to provoke the collapse of the talks over the issue. While there's no shortage of policy disagreements between the three parties, from defense spending to agricultural policy, the differences between the Greens and the two center-right parties on migration may be unbridgeable. This may be a bridge that they can't cross together. And so it's as I say, something to watch. Well, this article goes and talks about the continuing problem that Germany has with mass migration. I gave you that article just the other day about the tens of thousands that are supposed to be sent home that are unaccounted for. Another piece here from Reuters says this isn't quite on the election. I'll come to that one in just a second. The next one, Deutsche Welle, it says, could Germany's FDP sink Angela Merkel's coalition talks? The Free Democrats, that is. They say, according to this article, there's no guarantee that they'll do a deal with the new German government. The conservatives and the Greens. Are they just bluffing, Reuters asks? Or this is Deutsche Welle. Or do they think they'd stand to gain if a new election were called? I mean, there's already articles talking about the possibility of another election. And you keep in mind what my father said in 2010, this Daniel 8 man coming in by flatteries to just sort of tweak the democratic process or perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. It's pretty amazing how this is shaping up, how this is coming together. Further on in this Deutsche Welle piece, it says over the weekend, FDP leader Christian Lindner raised the possibility that talks could fail, which would necessitate new elections. And he reiterated that stance in Berlin on Monday. Meanwhile, Angela Merkel is saying that if there's a new election or a snap election, she says that would be a catastrophe. That's her warning. That's what she's saying. We can't have another election. We just had one at the end of September. The local has this to say. Coalition negotiations continued into a second round of preliminary talks on Monday, with Angela Merkel meeting other party leaders to try to break the deadlock. It says, rallying all the parties to show more willingness to compromise, Gunther stated that a failure to reach an agreement would be a signal of our inability to act and would create the perfect conditions for extremism to flourish. So if we can't pull something together, I mean, that could be dangerous as well for our country, for our nation. And of course, this comes at a time, when Europe itself is struggling. Europe is dealing with the migration crisis, with Brexit, and with a lot of financial troubles, economic troubles in some of the poorer states. Reuters, this piece I skipped over a moment ago, German army contemplates EU fissures in scenario study. In other words, the German army is they're going through exercises, preparing for the possibility of the European Union breaking up. They're preparing for it. And of course, we've been saying all along that it's about to be dramatically reformed or reshaped. This union, this club of 28 countries, one of them's already on the way out. And so that's pretty interesting take as well, as if some in the German army are well aware of the fact that this thing could all fall apart. And we've got to be ready. We've got to be ready to lead, to take the lead militarily. Well, lots to keep our eye on in Germany. And speaking of Brexit, and the UK, I went through a couple of stories, I believe, last week about the debate in the UK on what to do with those returning from ISIS, those 400 to 700 fighters that are now working their way back into Britain, of all places, settling back in to Britain. And this piece at The Spectator talks about how that while policymakers are preoccupied with Brexit, and now there's the big witch hunt in Westminster for who's the latest sexual predator. While all of this is going on, you have these hundreds of ISIS fighters returning to Britain. It says the return of these fighters has profound implications. The security services are struggling to keep up with all the possible terrorists at large. Notably, Andrew Parker, the director general of MI5, has warned that plots are being devised at the fastest rate that he can remember in his 30-year career. We touched on this last week. He stressed that the security services have prevented 7 attacks since March. Of course, a few of those attackers have gotten through. There have been four or five high-profile attacks right here in Britain just this year. 7 at least. 7 that have been prevented. It says it's overwhelmingly in the public interest to prosecute those who went to link up with ISIS. And this author gives a number of reasons why they should be prosecuted. And it concludes with this. What is more worrying is the sense that the government has lost clarity on the Islamist threat. Combating Islamist ideology in the UK is one of the great challenges of our time. It should give this country pause that so many hundreds of Britons were tempted to go and fight with ISIS. It should make this country pause and think and wonder, why is it that there are hundreds of Britons? And of course, these are Islamists living in Britain. That's what it amounts to. But why are they so quick to go off and to fight with ISIS? Well, now they're back. ISIS has been pretty much defeated. And so they're returning from the battlefield, settling back into their apartments in Manchester, in London, Liverpool, Leeds. One final piece here. This is from the New York Times. No one knows what Britain is anymore. This is Steve Erlinger, and he, again, the New York Times, I think the general sentiment in the leftist press is that Britain's losing its identity all the more because it's leaving Europe. But in any event, Erlinger touches on some things that we have talked about quite a lot over the years. Mr. Armstrong, in fact, when he talked about the sun setting on the British Empire, Erlinger says, having voted to leave the EU, Britain is unmoored, heading to nowhere. While on deck, fire has broken out, and the captain, poor Theresa May, is lashed to the mast, using this analogy as a ship, without the authority to decide whether to turn to port or to starboard, let alone what one imagines she knows would be best, which is to turn around and head back to shore. As I say, they're all for the European project. And he says here, I've lived and worked 9 years in Britain. Well, a few of his years were during Thatcher's prime ministership. And then now, I guess he lives here again. It says the ambitious, let me see if I can skip a little further down. It says, Britain, renowned for its pragmatism, its common sense, its political stability, and its unabashed devotion to small business, has become nearly unrecognizable to its European allies. Britain is undergoing a full-blown identity crisis. It is a hollowed-out country, ill at ease with itself, deeply provincial, engaged in a controlled suicide, say puzzled experts, and these are Britain's friends. Britain became a service economy, the empire disappeared, and people stopped identifying with the Church of England. Just a few highlights there from a piece at the New York Times, November 4th, over the weekend. Britain's identity crisis. And, of course, the danger, you put it together with the ISIS fighters and then now the scandals that are going to dominate the headlines, just like so many scandals dominate the headlines in the United States. This is Ephraim and Manasseh today. Even as we see the rise of all of these strongmen, all of these authoritarians, all of these threats abroad, and the sickness within, just as the book of Hosea 5, read that chapter. Read the entirety of it. Read about the sickness. Ephraim gets so sick, Judah too, that they have to end up reaching out to Assyria, reaching out to the power in Europe, that traditional enemy. They have to reach out to the Assyrians for help. That's where all of this is headed. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
The family unit must be trained in the ways of God, because God is a family. God is a divine family. And we are to be children of God and born into that family. And we have to learn to live as a family. We need to learn to live as a family. And that's why God gave us the family relationship. A husband and a wife that become a father and a mother. And then the children.
Sound quality is not the greatest there from that 1980 message from Herbert Armstrong. But the message is an important one. It certainly is relevant to what we're seeing today. The family unit, the fact that God is a divine family, that we are to be children of God, born into the divine family of God. And so God meant for us to learn how to live as a family through these God-ordained institutions of marriage and family. God created us male and female from the very beginning. He established marriage from the very beginning. Listen again to that particular message, 1980. Here's clip two.
God gave us sex to be a giving of love in marriage. And don't you forget it. That's what it is. A giving of love and affection and tender care and a feeling. A feeling for the good and the welfare of the other one instead of selfishness. It's not a selfish thing, not in God's eyes, where it's supposed to be. So, another thing, word we misuse. Anyway, God's great overall purpose is reproducing himself, and it gets into the family relationship.
That's the overall purpose that you have to view. Love, marriage, and sex through. You have to see it from God's perspective. Man has his ideas, his philosophies, his teachings. There's a proverb, Proverbs 14:12, that says, "There's a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." There's a way that seems right. And in Mr. Armstrong's writings, particularly in The Missing Dimension in Sex, he talks about swinging from one wild extreme, the old morality. The sex is shameful. To the other extreme of anything goes. Just in the last century, we've basically gone from prudery to pornography. Just a little more than a century. And neither of those extremes come from God. They're both from the devil. He says this is in Mystery of the Ages. Satan himself has no sex. He's resentful of the fact God has endowed humans with sex. Therefore, Satan sways humanity into making sexual sins one of the most universal and destructive. He says during most of the so-called church age, in Roman Catholic teaching and in England and in the United States since the Victorian age, sex was virtually forbidden. It was a virtually forbidden topic of conversation, seldom mentioned. Satan made sure sex was considered as shameful and so evil it was not talked about. He says about the turn of the century, Sigmund Freud, founder of psychoanalysis, changed all of that. Up until World War I, it was illegal in the U.S. to publish, sell, or even loan a book containing sex knowledge. After World War I, the legal barriers on the imparting of sex information toppled. An avalanche of books, pamphlets, and newspaper articles descended on the public. It says, yet in all this, the most vitally needed dimension of knowledge was missing. So we went from one extreme to the other. Sex is shameful. Don't talk about it. Don't bring up the topic. And then after World War I, the floodgates opened and sex was hurled at us from every direction. And what have been the fruits of both extremes? They haven't been good. I mean, going from prudery to pornography, it's, as Mr. Armstrong said elsewhere, it's like going from the frying pan into the fire. But both extremes are evil. Both are destructive. And both, as he said there, both lack the missing dimension in knowledge, the vitally needed dimension of knowledge about sex and marriage and why God created it. And that's brought out in Hosea, the importance of that missing dimension anyway. Hosea chapter 4. Let me just see if I can get over here real quick. Hosea, we've read these verses before on the program. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6. Notice this. It says, I'm in chapter 6. Hosea 4, verse 6. It says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you, that you shall be no priest to me, seeing you have forgotten the law of your God. I will also forget your children." Verse 7 says, "As they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame." Without this missing dimension, I mean, it's impossible to arrive at the truth. And of course, it's, as Hosea brings out there, it's leading to destruction. This flat-out rejection of God's laws regarding marriage and family, sex and love. This spectator piece, Douglas Murray, he's writing about this new, what he calls the new sexual counter-revolution. So we've gone through the anything goes. We've reached full saturation point. Pornography is ubiquitous. Big movie producers like Harvey Weinstein, I mean, they were there for decades selling this kind of filth, spreading it all over the earth. And now we come to find out that he's living the very same way so many of those characters on the silver screen lived. Douglas Murray says, "We are in the middle of a profound shift in our attitude towards sex, a sexual counter-revolution, if you will. And whereas the 1960s saw a freeing up of attitudes towards sex, pushing at boundaries, this counterswing is turning sexual freedom into sexual fear." So one extreme to the other. One wild extreme, now to another wild extreme. A couple of weeks ago in Doctrines, when we were going through the Ten Commandments, we got around to the commandment that forbids giving a false report or lying. And I mentioned to the students then, right at the peak of some of these scandals coming out of Hollywood, I mentioned then, given that Satan is the father of lies, given how much you can make if you bring forth a false accusation, if it sticks, you can destroy someone and even be paid off handsomely for it. I mentioned that it's only a matter of time before there's a lot of false reports that go out. It's impossible to know amid all of the he said, she said. It's impossible to know, you know, what's actually true. In any event, here we're going now to the other extreme where everyone's coming forward with stories or with incidents. Some of them going back 10, 15, 20 years. Murray says here, the rules are being redrawn with little idea of where the boundaries of this new sexual utopia will lie, and less idea still of whether any sex will be allowed in the end. Well, I don't think it's ever going to get to that point. But he brings up a good point about going now from one extreme to the other. And he talks about how it started innocently enough with Weinstein, and given all the accusations, given all the abuse, given the way that he evidently was using his position of power, I mean, you can see why everyone jumped on board. There's other aspects to this story, as I've discussed with you before. The fact that there should have been more voices coming forward sooner. In any event, everyone jumped on the bandwagon. Everyone was gleeful following his downfall. And now to see all of Hollywood come under scrutiny, there's quite a few people applauding that as well. But Murray says further in The Spectator, since then, the exhilarating and powerful weapon of social media has whipped this along in every unpredictable direction. A journalist from GQ magazine was given the heave-ho after that famously prim publication learned that he had made an ungallant pass some years ago at a lady who was not his wife. How that hack's opponents and competitors rubbed their hands with glee. Around the same time, a preachy hack from a left-wing website was found to have behaved grimly with women. And his career, too, was dashed to the floor by people high on the octane of unreflective moral outrage. Everyone's on their self-righteous high horse. That's what he's saying. Everyone now is outraged. After we've been living in filth, after we've been regularly consuming this filth, on television, in movies, on the radio. It says, this week, the urge to purge the pervs has turned on the House of Parliament here in the UK with stories about the Weinsteins of Westminster moving from the blogosphere to the newspapers. So far, this has centered on a list of 27 MPs alleged to have behaved inappropriately towards women and 13 towards men. There's talk of investigations and firings, but this, it must be remembered, is not a list of people alleged to have committed crimes. It is a compilation of people heard to have been in some way forward with male and female researchers. See, just any and every accusation that's coming forward, and social media is fueling it. God says about our land today that there's just no truth. There's no truth. We've talked about this a lot with respect to news reporting. You can't arrive at the truth. Everybody's got a different narrative that they subscribe to. Well, how do you think this is going to play out? It says here, among all this are stories which may need not only a focus, but a criminal focus. Some now public allegations will require a police investigation and maybe even prosecution. If the outing and shaming of sexual predators encourages other men and women who have been the victims of actual crimes to come forward, then good should come from it. Okay, there's some good. If it exposes pedophiles, if it exposes rapists, that's a good thing. But Murray says here, but it's away from the law, tied up in the hashtag MeToo movement that followed Weinstein's downfall, that the real revolution is happening. Accusations of genuine and monstrous abuse are being mixed with news that a cabinet member touched a woman's knee many years ago. This week, the Crown actress, Claire Foy, was forced to issue a statement saying she had not been offended after angry Twitter users pointed out that actor Adam Sandler had touched her knee twice during their appearance on the Graham Norton show. All of this, doesn't it highlight just how much we need God's perspective? Just how much we need God's laws? The laws, the principles, the rules, the way of life that's taught and enforced at God's college, in God's church. Not that any of us are without mistakes or sins. We all have them. But where would we be without the purity, without the holiness of God's perfect laws It says here, a new generation is being encouraged to redraw the lines of acceptability in a way that goes too far, Charles Murray says. Or no, it's not Charles Murray, it's Douglas Murray, sorry. Charles Murray is another author. But we're going too far, this Spectator piece says. What once was gauche has now become unacceptable. And from unacceptable, it is being made sackable. And then elided with the criminal. That is a long way to go in a very short time. Like he brings out, I mean, this is all happening. It's happening just in a matter of weeks. The lines are being redrawn. The rules are changing, and they're changing dramatically. And here he is, I mean, he's a conservative writer talking about the good that came from the sexual revolution. I mean, there's good in that, he says. And there's some bad in that as well. And if we had a chance to go through that again, wouldn't we want to do it so that we could get it just about right? And that's the sort of reasoning he has this time around as well. Look, this is all happening within a matter of weeks. The only stability we have is God's law. Otherwise, it's just ever-changing. That's the thing. He doesn't have the answers. Neither do those on Twitter or on social media that are running wild with their hashtags. He says here, when the sexual revolution began in the 60s, it reframed sexuality in the direction of greater freedom and license. But for all the good that that movement did it really do a lot of good, that movement? Well, there were obviously evils in the old morality. And Mr. Armstrong says you can see why they would go looking for answers that would eliminate the evils of the old morality, but they went from the frying pan to the fire. And now it could be something worse. He says, worse lies beneath these presumptions, not least the whipping up of fear and loathing between the sexes, a loathing familiar to male students who now appear to be treated as at best rapists in waiting. You think Satan's going to use this as an opportunity to attack the role of the man? To attack biblical manhood? To attack true masculinity, not the kind that so many in this world subscribe to, but as it's defined in God's inspired word, the Holy Bible. It says, foremost propeller of this is a form of modern feminism, which is in fact barely disguised misandry, or hatred of men is the meaning there. Take an essay from the sociology professor Lisa Wade. This is, again, Douglas Murray at The Spectator. Citing this essay by Lisa Wade, a sociology professor, which argues that we need to attack masculinity directly. I don't mean that we should recuperate masculinity. That is, press men to identify with a kinder, gentler version of it. I mean that we should reject the idea that men have a psychic need to distinguish themselves from women in order to feel good about themselves. This is a sociology professor, a female, a woman, a feminist, on the attack against men. Because the problem, you see, is not certain types, Harvey Weinstein and certain individuals like that. The problem is just men in general. Murray concludes here, or as Laura Prendergast has noted in this issue, other women writers have taken it upon themselves to issue strict instructions for men on how they must behave. This feminism isn't producing guides for helping men. It's producing manifestos for torturing them. And so there's a huge problem that has to be dealt with and addressed, going back a few weeks when this Weinstein scandal hit the news. And look at how man is, quote-unquote, solving the problem. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the way thereof, or the way that it ends, is death. The end thereof are the ways of death. That's how the proverb reads. It might seem right. It might seem like this is the way to go. Mr. Armstrong says in his book, This is the one that preceded The Missing Dimension in Sex. He said, in God Speaks Out on the New Morality, the way that seemed logical and right, coming out of the old morality prudery, those are my words, but he says, the way that seemed logical and right was to reverse the teaching and institute a new morality, accepting sex as good, to cure neuroses by abolishing repression and changing to permissiveness and promiscuity. This is what Sigmund Freud proposed. We've got all these neuroses. We've got all these mental disorders. And they're there because of prudery. And so we need a sex is virtuous approach. We need an anything goes approach. Mr. Armstrong says, if repression and inhibitions caused psychic disturbance, the cure, quote unquote, was to abolish repression and inhibitions, to call sex good, to make it available whenever and wherever impulse or desire led. And thus you have the sexual revolution, going from one frying pan to the fire, as Mr. Armstrong said. Well, let's just conclude with, he mentioned that Laura Pendergrast piece also at The Spectator, and she has a few interesting thoughts to bring out as well. But notice Isaiah chapter 55. I'll skip over another Spectator piece. I've read enough to you as it is. But I think the basic point that we could finish with is how much we need God's thinking on this subject of marriage and family, or dating before marriage. And think about just how much the world and the ways of this world, the sexual revolution, it reached its peak, I guess, in the 1960s. I mean, it's just firmly entrenched into our thinking, into our nations, into our entertainment, our television, our movies. And so much of that filth just rubs off on us, which is why we have to be grounded in the Bible, which is why we have to dig into God's Word. Isaiah 55 here in verse 6, God says, seek you the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto the eternal, and he will have mercy on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. See, God says if we forsake our ways and even our thoughts, then he'll have mercy on us. He'll abundantly pardon us. Now, that's quite a standard to live up to. In fact, it takes the power of God. It takes the mind of God to even do it. But we have to show God that we want it, that we're going to go after it. Verse 8 says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. Just think about how different, vastly different, our ways are from God's ways, even our thoughts. As I read to you already, there's a way that seems right. It seems right to a man. Seems like, okay, we've got this problem. We've got the old morality prudery. It's never discussed. Sex is shameful. And so, obviously, this is not right. So how do we solve it? Anything goes. All sex, all the time. Anywhere, anyone. That's been man's history. From one wild extreme to another. It's only in the truth of God, God's Word, that you find the God-inspired balance. God made us male and female. That's in Genesis chapter 1. He made sex. He made us male and female, and then at the end of chapter 1, he looked at everything that he made, including male and female, and he said, I'm well pleased. It's very good what I've made, what I've created here. And then he instituted the union of marriage, And he said, I don't have my Bible turned over there to chapter 2. But you know the story. God said it's not good that man should be alone. So he created the woman. And he established marriage, and he said, for this cause, for this reason, shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. And so there are clear and definite laws regarding marriage and preparation for marriage, dating, and the lead up to marriage. And everything that you see in this world is wrong. It's coming out of the mind of the God of this world, who is Satan the devil. God, the true God, the great creator God, he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. And so we turn to God for the laws that govern dating and marriage. We turn to God and his revealed truth. We turn to God for that missing dimension in knowledge. We go to God for the how-to. We ask him, Lord, help us. Help us to guide our steps the way that we should. We don't know how to walk. We don't know the way to go. We don't know how to date toward marriage. We don't know how to make a marriage work. We don't know how to raise children. God does. And if we're willing to follow his lead, there's a verse in Romans 8 and verse 14, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. God's Spirit must lead us. It's not going to push you or shove you or jerk you back onto the path, but it will directly guide you if we allow it to, if we follow God. My father writes in the Last Hour book, this is early on, I think in chapter 1 or 2, but he says here, it is not easy to know and be led by the Spirit of God. As we battle our own carnality and our own minds, we must know the Spirit. He says later, we must think as if Christ is sitting right there with us. And so this applies right across the board. If you're in a power position working with those underneath you, Christ is right there. If you're a woman showing up for a job interview, Christ is with you. That's the way we have to approach this. He says further, when single people date, they must date with Christ living in them. As if he were doing the dating, that will certainly influence your choices of whom you date and what you do on those dates. You look at all these scandals, and I mean, there is plenty of fault to go around. I mean, you could point the finger in 1,000 different directions. There's so much wrong with it all. Only when we put God back at the center of our lives can we begin to learn about that missing dimension. And listen, it will truly revolutionize your thinking. Is Jesus Christ really coming in your flesh through you, or coming in the flesh through you, my father asks, in everything that you do? If so, he revolutionizes your life. He revolutionizes your way of thinking. One final quote here, and we'll just conclude a little bit earlier today. I've got a lecture here in a few minutes upstairs. But it says here, in this is from September 1966, the Plain Truth magazine, and Mr. Armstrong says, God made marriage. He made marriage to be, if we understand and follow his ways, even to rely on him to select and lead us to the right one to marry in the first place. He made it to be the most wonderful physical or material blessing possible in this life. That's what God designed from the very beginning. Mr. Armstrong, I mean, he says much the same in a couple of other clips that I have here. I think this is an earlier broadcast from his radio program. But listen to what he said about marriage and the laws that govern it. Clip 3.
Now, God set a law in motion, my friends. God intended a man to have one wife, and God set a law about this thing of male and female and being joined as husband and wife, that if a man will just take the one wife that he's in love with and be true to her, she becomes a great joy to him. And he He loves her more and more as the years go by, if they understand God's laws and if they are true to one another and exercising the laws of God and the laws of marriage as God intended.
You see, as I've touched on recently, it really does get back to commandment keeping. If you're looking into the commandments of God, if you're studying God's law, and you understand that that sex is for marriage, and that preparing for marriage involves dating widely, dating a lot of different people, without any sexual strings attached, and then narrowing it down, as we tell our students at God's College, narrowing it down as you prepare for marriage, to eventually date exclusively, and then, of course, counseling for marriage, and then the engagement and so on. It's a process that flows along a very definite set of laws established by God. And if we will understand it and follow it, what a blessing marriage and family will be. What wonderful laws we have to guide us, holy and just, pure and righteous. One more quote here from that old radio broadcast, clip 4.
And I want to tell you, my friends, that God has given us some wonderful laws. If we'll go according to them, they'll pay off. They can make you very happy. Oh, I know there are some thorns on the beautiful rose bushes sometimes, and I suppose most marriages have their little unpleasant parts. That's only because of human nature, and we let our own natures get in the way, that's all. But God has set laws in motion that if we'll observe them, we'll get over all of those things, and you'll go along, and marriage can be very happy. Marriage can be very beautiful. And love is something that can just deepen and deepen as the years go by. Oh, don't throw it away.
Don't throw it away, Mr. Armstrong says. What a wonderful blessing it is to be involved in a happy, godly marriage. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.